There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
We're talking about attraction and why some of us are attracted to people who aren't necessarily that good for us. Bad boys, mean girls, narcissists, psychopaths, and otherwise pathological humans who can be irresistible to some of us. What causes this? Mental health counsellor Chastity O'Donnell is here from the Human Relations Institute and Clinics to offer some insight. And later on in the show, we're discussing the five languages of love. We've put the website on our Facebook, that's at DubaiEye1038, and Twitter at Dubai1038FM, so you can take the quiz and find out what your language of love is. Text us in and let us know. We'll be discussing the differences between them and what they mean later on in. We'd love to hear from you over the next few hours, and there are lots of ways of getting in touch. You can text us on 4001 or message us using the free Dubai iMessage app, or give us a call 04 423 1010. Do give us a little line and you're more than welcome to get in touch and speak to Chastity. She's on hand to help with your relationship problems. So whether you're single in Sharjah or married and miserable in Murdiff, get in touch. Good afternoon, Chastity. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Happy Valentine's Day. You're wearing red.
I am. It was a conscious decision. I had a black shirt picked out. I don't know what that says about me from a psychological perspective, but I did decide on the red one today.
Funnily enough, I nearly wore a black top and I'm wearing purple.
See?
You're looking very romantic in the studio this afternoon. What are your feelings on Valentine's Day, Chastity?
Oh my goodness. Valentine's Day is one of those holidays that it could be so wonderful and meaningful for a lot of people. At the same time, I think it does bring a lot of anger and heartache for others. So I like to think of it as a holiday of love, and that could be love to yourself, love to your family, friends, your community, the earth. There's all sorts of ways to show love, give love, receive love. And so I like to focus on that for Valentine's
Day. Not just romantic love.
No, not just romantic love.
So what are you doing tonight? That's the big question. I'm not asking you out. I'm just wondering what you're doing tonight.
You're welcome to join us. It's all about love. So yes.
For loving.
So tonight, hubby was very kind and on the ball and securing a reservation. So we're going to go out to dinner and I'm going to take some, you know, get to know you games with us. So,
wow, we're going to be talking about this later in the show. There's actually 36 questions that can help you fall in love on a first date or in a marriage. So do stay tuned. We're going to be talking about this later on. But I think that's a really great idea to kind of invigorate things. I personally feel like the whole Valentine's Day over commercial thing, people do definitely have a point, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. I made a card for my husband yesterday with my two little girls for them to give to him.
That's sweet.
You can cook dinner at home. I don't know. I think sometimes it's quite nice to have your consciousness drawn to making time to acknowledge people in your life.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And, you know, and whether that's commercialized or otherwise, having that attention drawn can be quite good. It's like when we did a baby moon, which is a new kind of idea. But to make time for conversations is always going to be a positive thing.
Yes. And there's something about the quality of the conversation where, you know, sort of trying to focus on ways to get to know each other again and again and again, because I think oftentimes we can get into the how's your day, fine, how was your day.
Are you listening in my house, Chastity? It's true though.
Yeah,
it's so easy to get caught up in the routine and the drudgery. But it's on a positive note, it's Random Acts of Kindness Week.
Yes.
It ends on February 17th, which is Random Acts of Kindness Day. Now, you at the clinic are doing quite a lot around this. Can you explain what is it all about?
So Random Acts of Kindness Week is, it's an initiative to try and, you know, become more aware that we are connected and the impact that we have on each other. And so it's the pay it forward, and it's not just relegated to one week. I think it's kind of like New Year's resolutions, that it's Random Acts of Kindness Week, and it's that reminder, like, well, we can reinvigorate how we can impact other people in a positive and simple way. And so it really is just about doing simple, small things. They don't have to cost you anything. And it can be to friends, family, strangers. It could be to your community. It's just about getting us out of, as you mentioned earlier, getting us out of our routines and being mindful that we're all connected and that we all have the capacity to impact each other in amazingly positive ways.
Why do doing random acts of kindness make us feel good?
Oh, well, there's something about, I mean, there's the feedback, which is seeing someone smile and knowing that you've made a difference in someone's life. So that in and of itself is powerful. There's also what happens to us neurochemically when we give and we do stuff outside of ourselves, which is also in itself a rewarding sensation. So there's so many different ways that doing a random act of kindness benefits us.
But do we feel good because we want that acknowledgement, we want that praise, we want that thanks? If it was to be anonymous and secret, would that make it more worthy, or does it not really matter?
I love that you brought that up, because I think this is a major issue for a lot of people when we're thinking about Random Acts of Kindness Week. So on one hand, there's the part of us, and I think that's kind of cultural phenomenon of, if you do something good, don't brag about it. You don't post it. You don't, you know, your gratification should come from within.
Oh, but we live in the social media age, and yes, what's that without, you know, RAC kindness, hashtag.
Absolutely.
But I think people do want that acknowledgement a lot of the time.
Sure.
You know, the kind of, pick or it didn't happen, that kind of philosophy. Mm-hmm. But hopefully that's not the case for everybody.
No, and there is something, I think, I'm of two minds. The mind is that, you know, yes, it's nice to do things anonymously, and if that's your jam, go for it. At the same time, and this is why I can get behind, you know, a more public display of random acts of kindness, because when you post something, when other people see it, they feel good when they see good things happening to other people, a lot of the time, not all of the time, but it's also inspiring to other people.
It might spark an idea.
That's why we do it. It's about the inspiration.
I love this story. This came from North Devon in the UK. Last year, a woman called Emma Doherty decided to embark on a mission. She'd said before she turned 30, she was going to do 30 random acts of kindness. She's actually, I think by all standards, a good person anyway. She specializes in massage for the elderly and works with dementia in nursing homes, and loves the job but wants to open up the good that she could do. So she did all sorts of random acts of kindness, set up a Facebook page so people could, if they found them, could let her know kind of what happened. I'll give you a few little things to spark some ideas that Emma did before she turned 30. She sent an anonymous birthday card to someone who was turning 100. She delivered donuts to the local fire station. She did a walk for charity. I really like this one. She left a book and a card in a baby changing room. And I think that as a new mother would actually be incredibly touching to have some kind of gift in a really unexpected place. So if you're thinking about doing some random acts of kindness, I've picked a few of my favourite. And Justine, I know the clinic has been, you know, learning about what other people are doing around Dubai. So if you've got any favourites, we can share them too. But I think complimenting people actually is really, really meaningful. So if you're out at the park, or, you know, complimenting someone to their boss, I think is a really great one, because, you know, and also complimenting a boss can be very powerful, because a lot of times there's not much praise kicked around at the top. But complimenting a parent on how well behaved their child is, that can make somebody's day.
Absolutely.
Even if they're not. But helping out that family or that friend who maybe has just had a baby or needs a bit of extra support, donating clothes. I'm terrible for this. Whenever you bring in clothes, try and donate something of a kind of a similar size or value. Emailing or writing to an old teacher who made a difference in your life.
Oh, that's beautiful.
How amazing would that be?
I felt that. Yeah.
How amazing. I'm just not sure Mrs. Anderson from Riding Mill First School's on Facebook, but I'll try and track her down later. Leaving a nice waiter or waitress the biggest tip that you can afford. Letting someone behind you go ahead of you in the supermarket queue. Giving someone a book you think they'd like. Being the person who puts a tip in the tip jar at the coffee shop. It says fewer people do that than you think.
Wow.
Interesting, hey? If you're throwing something away, pick up any litter around it and put that in the trash too. write something nice on that person's update who posts on Facebook constantly. We all have that person. They're probably a bit lonely. Mm. Let them have the parking space. Not sure about that one. Also, let someone into the lane. Again, not too sure about...
I'm not a saint.
No. There are limits to my kindness. Answer that email you've been avoiding. So I think there's some really doable things. As you say, it's Absolutely. Not about costing money.
Absolutely.
It's getting out of that mindset of thinking me the whole time. Mm-hmm. So what's the clinic been doing this week? Human Relations Institute.
There's lots. Some of my favorites have been, there was a number of shout outs to the people that make our life better in simple ways. So it's the coffee clerk, it's the security guard, it's the parking attendant, it's the cleaning lady. You know, can you imagine what life would be like without these people? So so it's giving them shout outs and donut deliveries have been happening, cookie
Always
deliveries.
Always welcome.
Absolutely. And some really nice projects related to things like helping the environment. So the focus has been on the different levels of random acts of kindness. And what I mean by that is being kind to yourself. What are the things that you've been promising yourself you were going to do and haven't done it? Of course, being kind to others. Have you been wanting to volunteer, being kind
That's
to your community?
That's a great one. Actually, text and please do something kind for special needs kids at Allendale Disability Centre. Make them feel happy.
Oh, thank you for bringing that in. In fact, years ago, I did. I used to volunteer at Al-Noor, and the work that they're doing with so many children with such variety of needs and capabilities is incredible. Like, biggest-hearted people, so
take the time.
Yes,
the environment I think is a really good one, and something that I'm trying, not always achieving, is every time to go to the beach, spend 5 minutes doing a cleanup. And there's actually an Instagram account called 5 Minute Beach Cleanup, and they repost photos from all over the world of people who spend literally, you know, you go to the beach for maybe 2 hours, mm-hmm. and spend 5 minutes just picking up that plastic, and you can post a photo of what you collect, and it can get reposted and inspire other people.
I love
so
that.
Easy and a great it one is. To get the kids involved in it is. As well. Now, here's something interesting. This was in The Guardian recently. Best-selling author of Crucial Conversations says couples who argue together stay together, research finds. It's not something you're likely to see on a Valentine's card, mm-hmm. But research is showing that the couples that argue will stay together longer. Crucially, couples who argue effectively are 10 times more likely to have a happy relationship than those who sweep difficult issues under the carpet, according to a survey of almost 1,000 adults. Mm-hmm. As an expert, do you find that surprising or not surprising at all?
It's not surprising, but with caveats. So the key word, I think, is effectively. And so there are healthy arguments and there are unhealthy arguments. And so when you think about couples that argue and argue effectively, they're communicating needs. They are feeling something and sharing that information with their partner. They're also, to a certain extent, receiving information, although when arguments get really heated, it's hard to take.
You don't listen to anything.
You don't. It's hard, but it may come in and then you process it later and you might go back to that person and say, you know what, I heard what you were saying and yes, I could be more patient or I can try and do things differently. So, I mean, underlying argumenting is communication. And so couples that don't argue, or what I think could happen, so it's important to unpack what that actually means. So couples that maybe have argued and found that no matter what they do is not helpful or effective, so they're effectively stonewalling, they're no longer communicating, that's very toxic on the relationship. And so inherent in that is not so much that they're not arguing, it's that they've learned that no matter what they do, it does not work. They don't communicate, they don't feel heard, they don't listen to the other person. And so I think that it's important to make that distinction between what is arguing and what is stonewalling. I don't want to talk to you anymore. I don't want to hear what you have to say. I'm just shutting down.
So how can we have an effective argument? I don't mean like how can we have an argument and win. I mean, what phrases, although that would be good to know,
yeah.
what phrases and words can we use in order to get our point across and be heard?
Mm, I love that question, especially the part about winning. it's not about winning. And they often say that you can either be right or you can be happy. And so something to think about. But one effective tactic is just how you start the argument, how you start the conversation. And research shows that if you use a softened startup, that I think it's somewhere between 90 to 97%, how you start will determine how you finish. And so rather than saying, you never put your dishes in the sink, you could say, you know, I would love it if you put your dishes in the sink. And just how you're starting sets the tone for the argument. So that's one thing that you can do. Another thing is looking at sort of understanding what are your solvable problems and what are perpetual problems. So this is all from Gottman. He's one of the world's leading researchers when it comes to couples therapy, marriage therapy. And if you know that there are just certain things in your marriage that or your relationship that you're not going to agree on, that's helpful because you know that those are sensitive issues. So just becoming aware of this is a problem we can solve. We don't spend enough time together during the week. Let's carve out some time. But if it's something related to one person likes to have a really tidy house and one person is like, well, you know, as long as the house is happy, that's all that matters. That's just something you're going to grow and love and respect and understand that that's going to be something that you just can't solve. And you're going to deal with that problem differently.
So arguments can be a good thing.
Absolutely. If done in healthy and constructive ways, when it starts becoming, you know, in any argument, you have a right to complain. It's when it becomes criticism that it can start veering off the
rails. I think it's such a big misconception that if you argue, you're unhappy.
Absolutely.
And people go into relationships and think, well, it must not be meant to be because we fight all the time. But as you say, there can be good fights and not so good fights. So
absolutely.
An interesting bit of news around Valentine's Day. Now, I'm sure you have heard this story, but we've had an update on this. More than 20 years ago, there was a psychologist called Arthur Aron, and he succeeded in making two people fall in love in his laboratory. And, like, first of all, an unbelievable claim. And a woman, years later, Mandy Lenkatron, decided to recreate this. She approached a colleague. She worked in a university and said, this is what he did. Let's try it. So what did he do? Put two strangers together, and they asked each other 36 questions and then ended in looking into each other's eyes for 4 minutes. So that's a long time.
It is.
So she asked this guy, you know, explained to him, let's give it a go. And they didn't go to a laboratory. They went out. And what happened? They fell in love.
Did they?
Yeah.
Wow.
3.5 years later, still very happily together. So over the years, she's now had people getting in touch saying, we tried the 36 questions, this didn't work for us, or we were in a marriage and it really has helped us. The questions are really interesting because the level of vulnerability increases as you work through these questions. So you don't actually notice that you're in kind of intimate territory until you're already there. And actually, if you're meeting someone for the first time, to address some of these answers might take normally weeks or months to get to that kind of content. So you are forcing intimacy quite early on. So yes, she did fall in love, and it's she's not crediting the study entirely because they worked together. It might have happened a lot longer. But I thought we'd have a look at some of those questions. As you mentioned, you're going out for dinner tonight with your husband. I'm going out for mine, and it might be quite nice to ask some of these questions.
Yes, please.
And to see if if you've got a first date tonight, we'll post a link on our social for these 36 questions that can lead to love. So it's fall in love with anyone, do this. It starts off quite, you know, innocuous. Given the choice of anyone in the world, whom would you have as a dinner guest? Would you like to be famous, and in what way? What would constitute a perfect day for you? When did you last sing to yourself or to someone else? So it's kind of the generic, I like this one. Do you have a secret hunch about how you will die?
Oh, I've never thought about
it. Well, exactly. And I think that's what Lacatron's found, is that actually she didn't mind so much opening about herself and receiving information from her now partner. But what some of the questions they ask are things like, what qualities do you recognise in the other person? And complimenting someone to their face, which is, again, quite an intimate thing to do to someone that you don't know at all. And also questioning things like, you know, what do you think we have in common? You know, to acknowledge something really early on in that relationship. Take 4 minutes and tell your partner your life story in as much detail as possible. And then it starts warming up to to things that are a little bit more intimate, like share with your partner an embarrassing moment in your life. Yeah, there's plenty. When did you last cry in front of another person? This is a horrible one. Of all the people in your family, whose death would you find most disturbing and why? So really getting to the crux mm-hmm. of big emotional issues. Mm-hmm. Do you think this, as a psychologist, could you see this, and as a counsellor, working?
Sure. And interesting, a number of those questions are related to, I think it's like fast friends research. And so what's interesting about the questions is that they take the emphasis off waiting for your turn to answer and look at actively listening. So they elicit a kind of curiosity. So if I asked you something like, if you had a superpower, what would it be?
You want to know.
I want to know. As opposed to...
Teleportation.
Really?
Yeah. I hate queuing. Hate traveling. Ugh.
Wow. Interesting.
What would yours be?
It's tough. Can I pick two?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. Flying.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and it would be to eat whatever I wanted and not gain weight.
That's a great one. I want that one too. So, please, Chastity. Thank you.
So those would be my superpowers. But see, and automatically, I'm actually interested in what you're saying, as opposed to if I asked you, where are you from? That question, I'm just waiting for you to answer it so I can determine if it's relevant to me and whether or not we're going to have some commonality. So what's interesting is that when we ask questions like that, like the ones you noted in the survey, we are curious about the other person. So it builds a level of intimacy. It builds a level of rapport that you don't get with the ordinary questions like, how was your day? And where are you from? And, oh, do you have any brothers or sisters? You know, because what are the answers to those? Like, oh, I live in Mirdiv. Me too. Where are you from? I'm from the UK too.
It's like it's actually meaningless, really. And often a big thing in the UK is like, where did you go to school? Where did you go to university? And it's a search to try and find common friends.
Yes. Absolutely.
Which, you know, of course, that there might be something in that, but it's clutching on to something that's not really in your soul.
Absolutely. That's it. And it's not conveying anything about you as a person and what's meaningful to you. And so although some of the questions seem quite silly, they're in other research related to helping teams coagulate. What's the word? Cohese, yes. And they're also, some of those questions are also in Gottman's literature as well. Again, helping people find ways, effective ways, like real ways of connecting rather than what we think about as questions for connection.
Chastity O'Connell, in basic terms, what is a bad boy?
Oh my goodness. A bad boy is someone who represents excitement, attractiveness, an edge, slightly dangerous, but not scary. So there's
you do have your instincts that kick in a little bit and go, stay away from the really bad one.
Yeah.
And why are they more attractive? To certain people at certain times.
Yes. So from an evolutionary perspective, I mean, if you look at what bad boys represent, they represent a kind of dominance, like the puffed up chest. You know, if you think about the animal kingdom, you know, the biggest, the strongest. And, you know, we are human beings thinking rational, but we are also driven by DNA. So you have these genetic urges toward reproduction. And so what they represent naturally sort of grabs our attention from an attraction perspective. I think what's important is this is where you start parsing out what is attraction, what is love, what is attachment, you know, so the different kinds of love that we can have. And also short-term versus long-term. So short-term, you want to reproduce those genes. Long-term, you want someone that's going to be around to help you raise
the
kids.
Yeah, you might not want to live with that guy.
Yeah.
But actually, research has shown that people with so-called dark personality traits, such as narcissism, psychopathy, yes. Machiavellism, which are known as the dark triad, are actually, unsurprisingly, better at making themselves physically appealing. Narcissists, shockingly, are really good at making themselves look appealing.
Sure.
And being more physically attractive. So bad boys can make a really good first impression.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, they're more fun. You know, it's the motorbikes and the, you know, they know how to have a good time. But genetically, you know, they're having a good time, their baby being dangerous, but they're also being safe with it, with, you know, they have these kind of nine lives thing that we recognize. can hormones play a part?
Sure. Well, there are certain times where you might be attracted to someone more strongly than others, and that can have to do with your own reproductive cycle, and that
ovulation goggles.
So yes, can I say that on air?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So related to ovulation, there's also your own level of self-esteem that has that is related to what you're attracted to as well, and what you're vulnerable to as far as pursuits from other people. So.
In kind of layman terms, so basically, if you're not feeling so good about yourself, there might be a guy who will say the right things and make you feel a bit better, but maybe not with the best of intentions.
Absolutely. So you're vulnerable to that. I mean, from a human perspective, we all want to be needed and found attractive, and that makes sense. At the same time, when you're feeling vulnerable, your decision-making process is different than when you feel good about yourself. When you're feeling vulnerable, you know, and the low-hanging fruit comes along and it's the shiniest, then you're much more likely to, you know, see where that takes you, as opposed to, you know what, this guy has nothing of what I'm looking for. You know, my sleazy meter is through the charts. So I'm gonna just walk away from this. But
that's easier said than done a lot of the time.
It is.
And as you say, a lot of it comes down to self-worth. Mm-hmm. What kind of repercussions can low self-worth then have on relationships?
That can impact in a lot of ways. So having low self-worth might be potentially taxing on the relationship if you are, you know, consistently expecting your partner to fill that part of you. So you need them to say the right things, to do the right things, that you don't find that kind of fulfillment in yourself. And so it's really important, especially when we're talking about work with couples, that if you have a couple coming in and one is maybe having a difficult time, maybe one partner is experiencing depression or anxiety, and you know, feelings of low self-worth are often related to depression or anxiety, you might treat that first and then resume couples therapy, as opposed to trying to do that at the same time, because that does have an impact on relationships.
Now, we're not just talking about bad boys this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I really hate the phrase crazy women, because I think that does a lot to kind of degenerate a lot of emotions. It can
Absolutely.
Be a very damaging phrase, but there are phrases that we can't say on the radio, but maybe that mean girl mentality of, you know, treating them mean and keeping them keen, mm-hmm. Which is something, you know, I've got guy friends who seem to really love this, mm-hmm. in women. What's that about psychologically?
So interestingly enough, it feels like there's, you know, bad boys. So there's songs about it. Bad boys, why do they make me feel so good? You know, and meanwhile, when we try to come up with the same term for women, it's, I think of that song, That Girl Is a Problem. Do you know that?
Yes.
Where it's not the same, you know, whether it's, you mentioned the word quote unquote crazy, that it's problematic, there's promiscuity, there's all these things. There's a negative lens that gets cast on women. And if we look at how that sort of mean girl, is it the mean girl that we're talking about, like the Regina George from Mean Girls, who displays certain characteristics that are very different than, you know, someone that we might consider a bad girl from like that Bad Girls reality TV show. So I think even defining what is a mean girl from finding the equivalent of bad boys is difficult.
Is it the excitement, do you think?
I think there's an element of challenge, excitement. So again,
challenge is an interesting word.
Yes.
In terms of chase.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being less accessible, and that's something that traditionally we know, you know, DNA-wise, men do enjoy the chase.
Sure, there's certainly that element of challenge and chase. There's, if you're looking at sort of excitement with no strings attached, if you're looking for, you know, again, the genetic pull, like if you're trying to reproduce, you know, we're pulled in those sort of genetic ways evolutionarily, and that's what that also represents. The mean girl is potentially confident and strong, and there's,
or seemingly so,
or seemingly so, absolutely. So there's a lot there that can be attractive.
We've had a message here asking for some advice, Chastity, saying, "Hi, my mother is always attracted to men who don't treat her well. She spends a lot of time catering to them and their needs, but doesn't get back any appreciation. It's very upsetting for me, and my resentment causes a problem between us. Is there a way to help her, or should I step away?
Unfortunately, that is common. I shouldn't say common. We see it more often. So there's a couple of things, I guess, questions to keep in mind is, when thinking about your mom, what is she like outside of relationships? And seeing if there's some other, you know, psychological or internal struggles that are going on to help sort of boost that self-esteem, boost that self-confidence. And from a psychological perspective, we also look at what does she get from these relationships. So what is she getting in the short term? Is it someone that's fun and exciting? Is it something to do? Is she sort of feeling lonely on the weekends and not having the opportunity to go out, and that's what this person represents? Or could it also be sort of reenacting past relational patterns of being the caregiver and not being able to be comfortable in a relationship where someone is good to her, because that's just not something she's experienced before. So there's all sorts of questions we can ask about that. But inherently, there's something to understanding what role does this relationship play? Is it that by caring for someone who isn't good for her, does it take the pressure off her own internal introspection, looking inward and maybe not being able to come to terms or come to grips with things about herself that she doesn't like?
And advice to the daughter?
I have a lot more questions, but I would say, she's asking, is there a way to help her, or should I step away? Well, you know, it sounds like you love your mom and you want to help her. So it might be helpful just finding a really comfortable space to sit down and say, and just talk to her, Mom, I'm concerned, you know, what do you see? And it's about that soft and startup.
What kind of questions could she be asking?
So, Mom, what do you see in this relationship? What are you getting from it? How can I, you know, what can I do to support you? And maybe we can, you know, go look at a dating site together, or maybe we can do more things together. Maybe I can help you get involved in a community, you know, group where she's out. So it's important to understand what is sort of pulling her to these relationships. And rather than giving advice, so what I was just saying is, like, maybe we can do this, maybe we can do this. It's really important to just ask and listen, and, you know, and be there and understand what is she getting from this relationship.
We're talking bad boys this afternoon with Chastity O'Connell from the Human Relations and Institute Clinic. And we're asking, have you ever been involved with a bad boy? How did it work out? Did you change them? But first this.
If you get hot, then you must get cool. Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad boys. What you gonna do?
What you gonna do when they come for you? Chastity O'Connell, what should you do when the bad boys come for you?
That was perfect.
How can we break the pattern of going back to these toxic relationships? And this applies to men as well.
Sure. And absolutely, I think that's a great point, in that men can be in equally as toxic relationships as women. So, and they might be in relationship with each other sometimes. So number one, I think, is over time, our needs change. And so you often hear about the situation where, you know, I dated so many duds and then I met my husband.
That's
and then
me.
So,
but that happens, right?
Yeah, because it's over time, your needs change and your level of awareness about what you need changes. So I think there's certainly an element of time, like the needs of a 24-year-old, the excitement, the interestingness, the, you know, postability, like how postable is he, changed when you're 35 and you're, you know, looking at a really exciting night, staying in, watching TV in your jammies. So not to say that all 35-year-olds do that.
I do.
And there's no shame.
There's no shame in that game at all. But I think it's interesting to, how do you stop being suspicious of people? Because what happened was, I think a lot of my girlfriends have had this, have dated these really wrong-uns, you know?
Yes.
And then you meet this nice guy. and you're suspicious because sure. he calls when he says he's going to call, and he's interested and meets the family, and, you know, or all of that. How do you kind of make that adjustment without pushing them away?
Sure. I think part of it, what plays a role, is that you just keep testing and evaluating. And that sounds very clinical, and it sounds very, I don't mean it to sound like a game, like it's not playing games with them. But when you are used to a certain level of interaction, you're used to a certain style of relationship, and something else is different, you sort of, okay, let's see, you're constantly saying, let's see where this goes. Like, is this going to work out? And so over time, when they consistently respond in the way that they have before, you start attaching to them. You start feeling connected with them. You start feeling comfortable with them. So I would just say, give them a chance. Just keep giving them a chance.
Nice guys don't finish last.
They don't. They don't. You
worth
know,
pursuing.
It's like what, you know, that joke with when you're in high school, what do you call the nerd in 15 years? Your boss.
Yeah. So or your husband.
Or your husband. So,
but that's a really good way of looking at it, too. That popular, brash kind of character in high school isn't necessarily the one you want to marry.
Sure, sure.
So, in terms of the bad girls or the mean girls, is that a behavior from a woman's point of view that tends to adjust over time as well?
This is how we get into the trickiness of defining what is the mean girl. Is it the bad boy, the girl in the leather jacket that smokes and rides a motorcycle?
Let's think Angelina Jolie saying things like, you know, she gets her scars from, you know, knives and bed and, you know, things like that.
Sure. So Angelina Jolie style. So again, our needs shift over time. And so that does shift. And so whether or not they are, you know, I don't know, as it changes over time, you know.
Settling down a
bit. Yes, they're settling down a bit. And we've seen that with Angelina Jolie. But, the person at 25, again, is not going to have the same needs. And from a developmental perspective, when we're looking at what sort of things we're going through in our 20s as opposed to what we're going through in our 40s, what we're looking for in a mate is going to be reflective of that.
But what if it doesn't change? Now, we had a text in earlier saying that her mothers continue to be in toxic relationships. Mm-hmm. What if you going through life and just keep on getting into bad relationship, for want of a better word?
Sure. So there is definitely an element of relational patterns and repeating them over and over and over again. And that can be indicative of perhaps some underlying psychopathology. And what I mean by that is if you're experiencing depression, you're experiencing anxiety, bipolar disorder, that disorder in and of itself will impact your ability to make decisions in relationships. So that's definitely one element. Another element might be environment and context. So in the situation that the woman brought up about her mother, you know, that's one snapshot in time now, but what happened with her mother and her father to produce her in the relationship? What was that relationship like? You look at childhood, you look at what has happened recently. And so there's a lot of questions that you can ask to sort of understand what function that relationship is serving, or how that is mom just looking for a bit of fun? So in this instance, you know, we have daughter being really concerned, and she was saying that yes, there's resentment that happens over time, but if mom's going in with short-term goals like, I just want to have a bit of fun, I don't want a long-term relationship, which is fair enough, then that's going to impact choices as well.
And also where you meet people can be quite an interesting, you know.
Yes,
as you said, driving towards my kind of community and through friends might be a bit more I don't know how to put this, a target-rich environment for nicer people.
On the couch on Dubai Today.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Joining me in the studio this afternoon, we have Chastity O'Connell, the mental health counsellor, and we are talking about bad boys. And I can't let you move on from this topic without discussing something that's been in the news recently. It's a British woman, and it was reported in British tabloids, and it's now gone a little bit international. It's a woman called Emmy who went to Amsterdam and fell in love with an unexpected gentleman. Chastity, he was an alcoholic drug user who lived under a bush.
Okay.
Is this bad boy too far?
It's not uncommon in relationships to have sort of different roles that people can take on in the course of
so
a relationship.
So diplomatic. I'm going to read what she said about him.
Okay.
I noted that his fingernails were black, his clothes were stiff and ragged, his beard was matted, and most of all, he reeked. Garbage and sweat, you know that homeless person smell. But this is a love story. It goes against all the kind of class obsessions. She met him and he was literally homeless. And he said to her, they met on a bench, and he said, I'll meet you here the same time tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And she agonized over whether she should go back, but was really, really drawn to him, mm-hmm. and did go back. And 10 years later, they have 6-year-old children.
Wow.
Who, now this made me giggle. The pair's 6-year-old twins are entranced by this tale. Daddy lived under a bush, they cry, and asked to be told the story one more time. Mm. What kind of dynamic is this, Chastity?
And so in this relationship, in all relationships, you know, we come together based on our needs. There are certain things we're looking for and need. And in this relationship, I would guess, without knowing the history, that perhaps the woman started taking on the rescuer role, in the sense that she saw the homeless man no longer as a homeless man, but a person potentially with a name, with a family, or with a background history, that was someone's son, that maybe was someone's brother, and started to see sort of a more human face to this person. At the same time, you know, there's something there to this sort of rescuer identity that people can take on. And it comes typically from childhood, where children experienced a sense of powerlessness in the family. And so they become so absorbed in other people and satisfying the needs of other people. And typically in abusive families, where they become so absorbed in either placating one parent and surviving the other parent, that they lose their sense of self, they lose their sense of identity. And so when they meet other people, it's about taking on whatever that person is representing. So in this case, she met someone that was a drug addict. She took that on, and it's like, well, I need to get this person help. You know, she met someone that was living in a bush. I need to take this person in. I'm sure if I clean them up, you know, I could save them. And we see this isn't all too uncommon, in the sense that you see this with prisoners.
That's
where,
an interesting dynamic. Yes. Women writing letters to men on death row, for instance.
Yes. And in the love letters that Ted Bundy received, Charles Manson received, people that have done heinous crimes, receiving marriage proposals and attention for it. So, you know, there is something that I can save him, I can make him different. If only I could love him, then that would help him change. So again, that rescuer identity comes out. It speaks to something internal, and people are drawn to it.
And it's a happy story. She says, as a feminist, I like the fact that we reverse the Cinderella story, but he saved me. Mm. So looking past the smell, which she says was horrendous, mm-hmm. And you know, going on those 3 dates, and 10 years later she has written a book called How to Fall in Love with a Man Who Lives Under a Bush. It's a niche title,
yes.
But I think that there is a bigger message, obviously, behind that.
Sure.
If you've been involved in a bad boy and got past it, or if you changed him, do let us know. We've had a text message saying, advice for coming out of a bad relationship. I really gave all that was needed to keep the relationship, but I was cheated and felt and feel so much down about it. Stupid, actually. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, mm-hmm. a lot of the time. But here's a question for you. On mm-hmm. Valentine's Day, Chastity. Mm-hmm. In my life, there's been heartache and pain. I don't know if I can face it again. Can't stop now. I've traveled so far to change this lonely life. I wanna know what love is. you heard me saying what a brilliant song that was. Yeah, it is a brilliant song. That was Foreigner, I Want to Know What Love Is. Now, I'm asking this question today, Trusty, because a book came out 25 years ago called The Languages of Love by Gary Chapman. Gary Chapman says, love is the most important word in the English language and the most confusing. Mm-hmm. Falling in love is easy. Staying in love is the challenge. The book is all about how you can keep your relationship fresh and growing amid the demands, conflicts, and just plain boredom of everyday life. Here's what Gary Chapman has to say about it.
When I wrote my book, The Five Love Languages, I knew it had the potential of enhancing marital relationships. I had learned years earlier that what makes one person feel loved doesn't necessarily make another person feel loved, and that couples were often sincerely expressing love, but they weren't connecting. And when I shared with them that we have different love languages and we have to learn to speak the language of our spouse, it changed the whole emotional climate. In fact, many couples have said to me, that book saved our marriage.
That book has saved marriages for 25 years. Now, it has sold 11 million copies in 50 different languages. It's been in the New York Times bestseller list for 8 years running. And as we said, it's 25 years old now. In the first year, it sold just 4,000 copies. But since then, it has become an absolute juggernaut with marriage counsellors all over the world and a really devoted following, actually listening to its wisdom. I first came across this book during my marriage preparation course, just before I got married. We had to have this like a group session where we talked about marriage and weddings and what it was all about. And we were each given a copy of this book. Now, have you seen the book, Chastity? That's your physical. It looks mega cheesy.
Yeah,
it's kind of purple and pink, and you know, it's got a kind of a sappy font on it. And I was like, this is not for me at all. Mm-hmm. But actually, as we talked about it, it started to make more and more sense to me. So Gary Chapman says, expressing love in the right language, we tend to speak our own love language to express love to others in a language that would make us feel loved. But if it's not their primary love language, it will not mean to them what it means to us. Mm-hmm. Can you quickly summarize what the five languages of love is all about? And then we'll go into what they are.
Sure. So what Gary Chapman mentioned was this idea of expressing love but not connecting. And I think that is critical. We see it in couples therapy all the time. You know, when you have two people come in for marriage counseling, there is rare that one is deeply deficient and one is the angel and the devil.
Even if they think that's the case.
Even if they think, and that's the thing, they may think that person doesn't care about them, that they don't love them. And so this idea of connecting is a really powerful one in relationships. And so when you're working with couples, it's important to sort of humanize that person. And one of the ways you can do that is looking at the reality that they are expressing love in a way that is reflective of how they would like to receive love.
So as the title suggests, there are five languages of love. And based on his theory, people tend to naturally give love in the same way that they receive it. And it's about connecting those feelings of love and contentment. So they're all fairly self-explanatory on the surface, but we'll have an in-depth look of what they might mean. So the first language of love is words of affirmation. So this would be, it's more than just giving compliments. It's more like, oh, darling, your hair looks amazing today. Or I love you. It's recognizing something in them, saying, I'm proud of you, or I really admire how you handled that situation. That wasn't something that I could do. Mm-hmm. Something that's what he says is sustenance for their soul. And it is surprising just how simply acknowledging a job well done or saying thank you when they do something nice for you makes your partner feel loved. Mm-hmm. And appreciated. So it's about lifting people up with positive affirmations, and also people that have words of affirmation might be more wounded by insults or negative comments. So giving compliments, words of affirmation, I love you. Anything to add on words of affirmation, Justin?
Mm-hmm. I think you hit the nail on the head. It's not just a compliment, it's feedback as to what you love and appreciate about that person, and it's powerful. And in fact, if we look at it from the opposite end of the spectrum, verbal abuse, we know that that can tear people down just as much as physical abuse. So words do matter. And I think when we start thinking about positive words, we're like, oh, compliment, what does that do for anybody? But it really, words matter.
Can you tell us about acts of service?
Acts of service. So acts of service are things that are related to showing love rather than telling love. So you might see this play out in marriages or relationships in the sense like, well, she should know I love. I don't know why I'm taking on a man voice, but she should know I love her. You know, I put gas in her car yesterday and she didn't even ask me. And, you know, I, you know, got her tickets to this, you know, show that she's interested in. I did the dishes. I put the kids to bed. These are the ways that doing something for someone else, in keeping almost with Random Acts of Kindness Week that we have going on this week. So acts of service could, you know, look like some of the things I mentioned, doing laundry, packing lunch. You're doing something for someone.
I've just had a light bulb moment about my husband, actually. So he's not listening, so I can say this. We don't normally share a bathroom, which I do believe is the key to a happy marriage. But we had guests in town over Christmas, so we were sharing a bathroom. And he noticed that the shower rail was probably, I'd say, like a 5 degrees lower than it should have been. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, Helen, you know, what I can do is I can get some fishing wire and I'll put a hook and then that'll straighten out. And I was looking at him as if he was completely like, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter to me. Mm-hmm. Or he spent, you know, 2 days researching AstroTurf for our garden. Wow. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. But I think perhaps acts of service is a typically more male, I don't know. It seems to me that's something that would be an easier thing for guys to do.
Sure.
That's interesting. That was a bit of a click for me. So good. Acts of service. So, but you don't want to, it's not like doing everything for everybody. Mm-hmm. It's things that would be meaningful to them and making sure that they understand that you doing that act is your way of expressing love.
Absolutely.
Okay. How about receiving gifts?
Receiving gifts. Who doesn't like receiving gifts?
Well, quite a few people.
Exactly. Some people like receiving gifts way more than others. And again, we hear this in relationships struggles, which is, I don't need you to give me fancy things. I just need you to be with me. Or, you know, it would make me happier that you wrote me a handmade card rather than gone out and, you know, gave me 100 roses. So this idea of receiving gifts is people put thought and love. Really, they're putting so much into giving to someone else. And it's not about the people that are high in this. It's not materialistic. It definitely is not that. It's that tangible expressions of love, just like words matter for the affirmation folks, just like deeds matter for the service folks. Little things matter.
So it's not about spending money. It's not being shallow or silly. So it could be, as you say, a handwritten note or a flower or mm-hmm. going to a bookshop and picking up something that they might like.
Sure, absolutely. You can do things like, you know, getting their favorite candy. You know, oh, I know you like the dark chocolate galaxy bar and I saw one in the grocery store and I picked it up for you.
Is that a hint, Chastity? But is it fair to say that people who give gifts as their primary language of love also like receiving gifts?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that's something that a partner should be clued into.
Sure.
And next we have quality time. Mm-hmm. I find this a really confusing concept of quality time because sitting watching TV together, would that constitute quality time or what does it really mean?
So quality time is, it can, like most of these, they're going to shift slightly from person to person and how the details matter. But quality time is really where it's individual attention, you're focused on that person, and it doesn't take much. It's not like we need to sit here for a half an hour gazing into each other's eyes. It's about, right now, I'm with you. You're the focus of my attention.
Put your phone down.
Yes, the phone. Put the phone away. And for the next 5 or 10 minutes, it's just you and me. And it really doesn't take much. But it's that feeling connected, being with the other person.
Could it be something as simple as, you know, spending a Saturday afternoon going around doing errands and, you know, mm-hmm. just being together?
There could be that being together and it varies from time to time. And so it could be just that proximity of being together. It could be that I need to feel connected to you. So that might take shape of a conversation. It could be that we're just sitting alone watching a TV together, or watching a TV show together. So it can take the shape in various forms, just like, you know, the other love languages.
So. Okay. Yannick says, we've known each other since the mid-90s. We've seen good times, we've seen hard times, and I'm sure we'll have a better time ahead of us. Love to my better half. Just lovely. Mental health counsellor Chastity O'Connell is here from the Humans Relations Institute and Clinics. She's on hand to answer any questions that you might have, so do get in touch. We're talking about The Languages of Love this afternoon. It's an iconic book, sold over 11 million copies in its 25 years in 50 different languages. And it's actually surprisingly useful. I'm not normally a big fan of self-help books, but Chastity, there's a lot of truth here that I think can be applied to a lot of people.
Sure.
The basic premise is that each of us have one primary language of love and a secondary language of love. We've run through them very quickly. We're going to talk about our last one here, but they are words of affirmation. They are acts of service, receiving gifts, quality time, and physical touch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, physical touch is not about necessarily romantic or sexual touch. Mm-hmm. It can be proximity, mm-hmm. holding hands. Can you give us a few more insights on that language of love, Chastity?
Sure. Well, physical touch is, I mean, it's a thing that is that helps us thrive and grow from infancy. And so babies need it. So it's not surprising that physical touch is up there. And for some people, it's way more meaningful for that hug, that touch, that brush on the shoulder, that sitting close and cuddled on the couch. That is one way of many of expressing love. So yeah, it doesn't have to be sexual.
What if you've got a partner who doesn't like being touched? How can you broach that if physical touch is your primary language?
Sure. Well, part of it is just communicating about that. And, you know, we know that it's not about changing the other person, but building awareness of what's important to you. And that's what relationships are about. So if you know something is bothersome or something is needed in the relationships, and through communication, through mutual respect for each other, it can be something that you can shift on. Again, it's not about like, oh, I'm going to change you, you need to do this. It really is, this means a lot to me. And so when you know that something means a lot to your partner and you're coming from a place of love and respect, then you know, there's that shifting in your behavior of how you think about and how you express love to them.
If you're curious about what your language of love is, well, you might be surprised. I was surprised by mine. We've actually posted the quiz. It's on our Twitter and it's on our Facebook. So that's at DubaiI1038FM on Twitter. And we've actually got a poll where you can say what yours is, and we'll be updating you later on in the show. We've had a message from Christian saying there is a French saying that translates roughly into "the heart has its reasons, that reason can never know." So not always logical, huh?
No, and there's a lot. We say love, and even that word is kind of a funny word because I use it to describe how I feel about pizza, the same way as I might use.
I'm passionate about pizza, Chastity.
So, and it's funny I said pizza because I love steak. I should have said steak rather than pizza, but you use the same word that you would use toward a donut or a steak as you do toward your children or your parents. And so love, even of itself as a word, there's so much more there.
It's very broad. Now, question that came in on the text line saying, we've done the quiz already and we have different languages of love. Is our relationship doomed?
No, you are fine. So part of what is, I think, what has made this book so successful and what is so useful about it is that it's very practical and it's not aimed at pointing fingers. It's a bit aimed at self-awareness first. We know that in relationships that the more aware you are of the baggage you bring, the things that you need, the more that affects how you see your partner. And so bringing that awareness of how you express love, in fact, it will be more helpful to know than it would be not. And I've had that happen with couples where they just feel like they're not connecting. They're consistently like just missing each other, but they can still acknowledge that the other person is a good person, but feeling increasingly disconnected. They take the quiz and all of a sudden that other person becomes human because they have that click like, oh, you show love because you do things for me, and yet I've been needing you to spend more quality time with me, and I need love from you, and you keep doing more things for me, and all I want is just to spend time with
you. Stop doing the dishes and come sit next to me.
Yes. So, I think part of what's helpful is once you understand where you are with your love language, it is a springboard for what could follow as fruitful and helpful and effective communication on how to address it.
I've got a message saying, married for 35 years, my best friend, my teammate, father of my children, grateful for all these years together and the ones still ahead. Your French bird loves you, Michael. Oh, feeling the love this afternoon. Now, one for sports lovers, the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championship is returning to the tennis stadium from the 19th of February until the 3rd of March. It consists of the WTA Premier 700 Women's Tournament, followed by the ATP 500 Men's Tournament. Andy Murray took the title last year in the men's, and the tournament promises non-stop action over those 2 weeks. Tickets are available from 800tickets.com. Dubai Duty Free Tennis taking place from the 19th of February until the 3rd of March. As I mentioned, I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor, the Human Relationship Institute and Clinics. Oh, wearing your red and looking so romantic this afternoon, Chastity. We are talking languages of love. For those of you who have not read this book, you might be in the minority. 11 million copies have been sold in the last 25 years. And as I've said, it's a super cheesy cover, but once you get past that, don't judge a book by it. There's a principle that really can be applied to so many relationships, marriages, and even children.
Absolutely.
Gary Chapman has written a spin-off to his original book, The Five Languages of Love, talking about family life. Let's quickly recap on the five languages, Chastity, and then can you talk to me about the children?
Sure. So the five love languages are, starting with words of affirmation, these are, it's not compliments. It's not just compliments. It's verbally saying how you feel and what you appreciate about the other person. Quality time is number two, and quality time is, you know, being able to give that person your attention, however brief. The emphasis is on quality over quantity. It's not about being together every minute of the day. It's about feeling connection when you are. Number three is receiving gifts. Again, this is not for materialistic folks. This really is about those tangible expressions of love, and it can be everything from concert tickets to your favorite band to a homemade peanut butter and jelly sandwich just because. Acts of service, and this is things that you're doing. You show love by doing nice things. And then there's physical touch. This doesn't have to be about romantic. It can be about sitting next to each other. It can be things like kissing and holding hands, but it's everything else in between.
So that's kind of tactile.
Yes.
We had a message from Mark saying, hey, Erica, I've cancelled the maid. I'll do the ironing. Mark, kiss. That's a good act of service right there.
That is very, very cute.
So how do we translate these languages of love to our relationship with our children then?
That's a great one. Well, just like we have ways that we show love, that we like to be loved, and the things that bother us, so do our children. They have their own personalities that are in development, their own temperaments. And some children, and you see it, you walk into any classroom, there's the child that is, you know, that loves praise when you say so many nice things. There's the child that when you're just that wants to be next to you. There's the child that likes to give you those little handwritten cards that they've made, or they like to share their potato chips. Although they shouldn't have potato chips at school.
There's healthy homemade.
Yeah, healthy homemade quinoa.
The snacks are available.
Yes. And so it's about recognizing children as individuals and meeting them where they're at. So I think it's very powerful for facilitating connection with our children and loving them in the way that they need to be loved.
The physical touch, I think, is really interesting when it comes to children, especially around the kind of idea of consent as well. You know, we're so used to, you know, hug. I'll give her a hug or give her a kiss, bye-bye. And some children just are not tactile creatures, and I have a young baby and a toddler, and I, you know, friends who've got babies as well go, oh, I really wish that mine was a little cuddly koala, but she doesn't want to hug me. And it's innate. It's part of people's personality. Some people are just not physically tactile. Interestingly, there was a survey done in 2010 talking about the importance of touch, elderly nursing home residents apparently tend to feel unwanted and unloved due to lack of physical contact with others. And even things like if you want somebody to do something for you, some people are more receptive if they have been touched. So individuals who are touched are more likely to agree to participate in, you know, like a mall interview, you know, when you get kind of stopped and asked questions. Or even coming to money or cigarettes, people are more likely to give someone a free cigarette if the request comes from a person who touched them at the same time. So it can be quite interesting to, not to manipulate people, it's not about that, but it's about an understanding of, of what works. But in terms of children, obviously quality time is going to be a big one for kids. Gifts, is that something we should be, you know, some kids love stuff, some kids might not be so interested.
True, and gifts, I think, especially here, I think we start thinking about gifts in big, grand, glittery, fancy ways. But the gift of your time, the gift of doing a project with them. You know, just recently, we went in and did a plastic bottle project in one of the schools. And I have never seen children more excited to play with a plastic bottle.
What were you making? What were you doing?
We were making plastic bottle flowers. And so we're trying to do a project that generated as little waste as possible without asking for a lot of money, and, you know, don't using items that people are like nail polish, you know, give us the nail polish that you're not going to use, that you're going to throw away, that it's going to find its way into a landfill, and let's do something with it. And, you know, and recycling projects can be kind of iffy with kids because you go in there like, well, I don't want to play with trash, but there was not one comment related to anything other than, wow, this is so cool. So it doesn't take much when we look at gifts. And this is where we get into things like stickers or, you know, just drawing a little star on their hand because they've done something nice that day. So gifts, less is more when it comes to kids.
Especially here when there is I think it's pretty fair to say, a more materialistic slant on childhood here.
Absolutely.
Actually, one thing I was going to ask you separately, but I'll ask you on air, was about gift giving around birthdays and holidays, because both of my kids are born in the early part of the year. So we've just had Christmas. Mm-hmm. We didn't open all of the presents at Christmas because we just didn't, you know, your family's like. So we've been put back to their birthdays and we still haven't opened them. What do you think about us having a no gift policy when it comes to children's birthday parties?
Oh, I love this topic, because for so many reasons, I think part of what is so wonderful about the gift is acknowledging that someone gave it, who gave it. Oftentimes kids get so many presents that they don't even know, they don't know how to thank anyone properly. Gratitude is so important. And so you know, with so many presents, you miss out on this really beautiful process that could happen, that someone thought of me, they gave me this, I got excited about it. But it's kind of like chocolate cake. I don't know why I have a lot of food metaphors, but I do. But, you know, chocolate cake is wonderful, but having chocolate cake, you know, 4 times a day or 10 times a day, you know, the equivalent in birthday party presents, it just loses its taste and its meaningfulness. So it's something that is, I think, an important discussion to have. So I also feel this way about gift bags.
Oh, do you want to hear what I did for gift bags?
My daughter's birthday? Tell me.
We did books. I bought 20 books, and they could just pick them out of a bag, because we get a lot of gift bags, and, you know, truth be told, it's a lot of plastic. It's a lot of sweets that I don't really want her to have when she's already hopped up on party food, and you've got to hide them, confiscate them. Are they even necessary in the first place? Is there an expectation of going to a party and leaving with a gift on someone else's birthday? That's a bit weird when you break it down.
I don't know how this whole gift bag thing just went off the rails, but and you see it with children, you know, they show up the party and they're like, where's the gift bag? It's like, no. We're here to give a gift, not take something home. So I think there's a lot of big questions here.
What would you suggest for I mean, is it rude? Could I put that on an invitation saying no gifts, please? Does that mean, is it rude? Because some people love giving gifts.
Sure. And this is one thing. The one thing that's important is to you know, be mindful of what are your values. And if it is something like no gifts, please, if you feel so inclined, you can donate to a children's charity. We had a shout out to Al Noor, you know, donate to some of the charities around Dubai, which I think can be incredibly meaningful for children. If people feel obliged to give a gift, then there's a graciousness in receiving it. So it's one that I think you just have to wrestle with, talk with, you know, your partner. And also if your child is old enough, talk with them about it. You know, is it something that maybe you might ask them to bring plants and then they can go and plant, you know, plants in a garden or something like that.
Or books are always a good
books
one.
Are great. There's all sorts
actually,
of
that would be a really nice way of doing it. Say no gift, but please bring a book. And then everyone could share what their favorite book is and you get something from them as their collection. If you've got any thoughts on gifts and kids, we've gone a little bit off topic on Valentine's Day, but that's okay. See, we're talking about the five languages of love. It is a big book. I just want to play a little clip from the author, Gary Chapman.
When I wrote my book, The Five Love Languages, I knew it had the potential of enhancing marital relationships. I had learned years earlier that what makes one person feel loved doesn't necessarily make another person feel loved, and that couples were often sincerely expressing love, but they weren't connecting. And when I shared with them that we have different love languages and we have to learn to speak the language of our spouse, it changed the whole emotional climate. In fact, many couples have said to me, that book saved our marriage.
That book saved our marriage. Chastity, you work as a counsellor here in Dubai and work with couples. Could you see the truth in the languages of love and how it could help people whose relationship needs a bit of work?
Absolutely. It's really building that awareness of how you receive love or how you need to receive love, how you express love. And also there's inherent in there is what you need, what you're communicating from that you need from the other person. So it's not just about learning about, you know, your love language. It's what you can do with it. And I think that's what makes it so practical. And the reality that you can have more than one, that's something that I think needs to be pointed out, that we don't have just one. We might have one primary or prominent love language, but there's a combination of.
So let's just recap on those five languages. And we have got a quiz. If you go to our Twitter, which is at DubaiEye1038FM, we've posted the quiz and you can tell us what your love language is. And shortly I'll be revealing what the most common is in amongst our listeners. But what are those five languages, Chastity? And what if your partner has one? How can you reach out to them and communicate that love language to them?
Sure. So the five love languages are words of affirmation, positive feedback to your partner, quality time, spending time together, receiving gifts, doesn't make you materialistic, acts of service, showing, doing. You do things for them because you genuinely want to and love to, and physical touch. One thing I do want to add a caveat with acts of service and with physical touch is that when we're looking at relationships that are characterized by physical abuse, these don't apply. So that's important to those listeners that might be in relationships that are not healthy, that are not constructive. That's a different situation altogether. And what can people do in those?
Yeah, let's say my husband is a quality time kind of guy. What could I do to kind of bridge the gap?
Well, if your partner's a quality time kind of person, you can ask them what are the things that they might enjoy doing and the things that you can do together. And so you just make plans for some of those activities. And again, it doesn't have to be, oh, we need to go to Thailand or the Seychelles. It could be something as simple as I've been meaning, you know, I really would like to try the trampoline park.
Is this a hint, Chastity?
This is such a hint. I am unabashedly in love with being on a trampoline, and getting my husband on a trampoline is my mission of 2018. So
good to have a resolution, I feel. Yes. What if your partner is about giving gifts, perhaps one of the easiest ones?
So if they're about giving gifts, then what you might do is keep a little mental note or an Excel spreadsheet I can keep that Excel spreadsheet. When you hear them mention things like, oh, that's really cool, or oh, I'd love to get one of those, you just jot it down. And when the time is right, you give the gift. You know, so keeping a mental log of the things that your partner's interested in. And if you think about what that is, it's, again, it's not about, you know, trying to, it's about listening. Like, underlying that love language is, I'm listening to you, I'm attending to you, I'm trying to meet and give you what you want, what you're expressing.
It's so interesting, actually, because a lot of the time when it comes to psychology and self-help, it's about understanding yourself. Mm-hmm. Whereas this time, it's actually really analyzing what your partner needs and trying to meet that in a way that might not come that naturally to you.
Sure.
So it's about understanding on both sides.
Absolutely.
What about words of affirmation?
Words of affirmation.
How can I reach my partner if they're all about words of affirmation?
So words of affirmation, I think this one is a tricky one, because there are many different cultural groups that think that stiff upper lip, you know, you don't boast and praise people. So it's just being aware that maybe you have that, might have that tendency. This might be difficult for you, but you know, it could be something as simple as just setting your phone to give you a reminder to compliment your partner once a day for a month. Use
if
technology.
If that works, go for it.
It is. Or it could be just, you know, once a day, I am going to say something nice. And what I will say is that even if this feels fake it till you make it. It's the effort. It's showing that you're demonstrating that, look, I don't feel comfortable doing this, but I'm going to try. But I will also add a caveat. If you're in a relationship that is abusive, this does not apply. We're doing this with love, not out of fear or obligation.
Okay. And lastly, acts of service. What if your partner is all about those acts of service? How can you meet them without feeling like you're making them cups of tea all the time?
So acts of service is kind of a funny one, because you already know, because you've probably been nagged about it by this point.
Oh, so I really need to get the car booked in for service next
See?
Week.
Yes, I need to make that dentist appointment that I've been putting off. So this is really attending to, with a gentle and patient heart, the things that you've been asked to do or nagged about, or said, you know, gosh, it'd be really nice if someone did this. Then those are the things you take a mental note
They're
of.
They're cues.
Yes.
If you're curious to know what your language of love is, you can go to our Facebook page or our Twitter, DubaiI1038FM, and do the quiz. We've had a poll up all morning, and Chastity, I'm going to reveal what the most popular language of love is. Have you got any predictions?
I'm going to say words of affirmation.
Words of affirmation was second, but a whopping 83% of people say quality time is their number one language of love.
Oh, wow.
It's huge.
Yeah.
It just goes to show that this Valentine's Day, and perhaps for the rest of the year, we should put our phones down and book some time in.
Yes.
Chastity O'Connell, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiI1038.com.